This episode was co-produced with Splint Invest, a regulated Swiss financial institution that helps private investors diversify their portfolio by providing easy access to alternative investments like art, luxury watches, and rare whiskey. With the Splint Invest app, you can start investing with as little as 50 Swiss francs. And in fact, Swisspreneur listeners can make their first investment for free by downloading the app and entering the promo code DOLLY24. Click the link in the description to learn more and redeem your investment voucher.
I was there in February, and actually it's famous for cross-country skiing. So you see all these signs, but zero snow. When you read the news and when you look at things like that, you really feel it. It's not instant gratification, it's the opposite. It's instant horror.
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. If you enjoy listening to our show, make sure to follow the podcast and leave a rating. And now, here's your host, Sylvain.
Manoush, a very well welcome to the Swisspreneur Show. It's a pleasure to finally, after many, many attempts, have you here as a guest today.
Yeah, exactly. I'm really happy to be here. Very excited and looking forward to your difficult questions as always, I'm sure. But thanks for the invite.
Glad that you made it. You are an entrepreneur and founder of companies like Tree12, Unleash 12, Spice House Ventures, and of course, Join.com. You're also a startup investor, currently working on a stealth climate venture that we're going to talk a bit more about in a few minutes. Before we do so, I actually want to talk about your personal background. You were born and grew up in the UK. Your parents have roots in Sri Lanka, but then you moved to Switzerland. What was it like having a migration background in Switzerland? And what similarities do you see between that mindset and also entrepreneurship?
That's a good question. I mean, generally, right, I think everything's an even playground, but it is, you know, it's not necessarily easier with a bit of that. So I would say, interesting point. So I actually came here when I was fairly young, and people do tend to generalize, maybe even judge a book by its cover. So I think it was tough not speaking a word of German and definitely not Swiss German when I got to Switzerland. So I think sometimes I did, at the beginning at least, I did have to work harder than others maybe. I think I had like 15 or 20 hours of Deutschzusatz, so extra German lessons per week, by the way, during school. So that was pretty heavy. But I think what that teaches you as well in young years is that I think, you know, with a little bit of heavy work ethos and tenacity, you can get better. And maybe that taught me that mindset, because I don't feel necessarily there are great people building companies. I don't necessarily feel you're more intelligent or less intelligent. But I do think there are very few people who can put their money where their mouth is and work hard. So I think that really helped me. And maybe, you know, working hard for something is not something that comes easy to a lot of people. So that might have been something that I learned in my young years.
I love that. And then you also worked probably very hard for companies like Procter & Gamble, Adidas, and others before you then joined your first startup, Groupon. What motivated you to join this very ambitious and also a bit aggressively growing project?
Yeah, for sure. No, so I hope everybody still knows Groupon. I don't think it's a brilliant product, but it was a very interesting scaling story. But okay, yeah, good question. I think maybe I liked the shinier things when I was at university. So the brand names of large companies like Procter & Gamble in marketing, or Adidas, just if you like sports and you want to work at one of the world's best, and the best in Europe for sure, the largest in Europe. Not to say On isn't the best these days from Switzerland. But that said, it felt to me one of the things that I realized is I have a love-hate relationship to corporates, because essentially, right, you can learn from people that have that deep domain knowledge, like massively over years and decades. But at the same time, the company isn't very fast and agile. So that's what I like about startups, and that's what I hated about the corporates, right? But that deep domain knowledge is something you miss at startups. And maybe, fun fact, I was sort of a young guy in a company called Usgang.ch during university. So the others were 5 to 6 years older than me, and I was just founding and running the East of Switzerland. So I had a great time, for those of you who know Usgang.ch in Switzerland. But I had that experience, and I really was missing that. And that's what I did later when I actually went to Groupon.
Amazing. And Usgang.ch, you know, you've done so many things. We don't even have the time to mention all the projects that you have been involved in. Usgang.ch got also acquired later down the road. And Groupon IPO'd during your time there as managing director. But you also were a managing director and founder at Tree12 and Service Partner One, both of which had exits in the double digits. So I have to ask, like, it seems that exits just follow you over and over again. Do you have like a Midas touch to you?
So, well, that would be nice if that was the case, but I don't think I do. I think you're just lucky because you have great people around you, and I think you're able to work productively and progressively improve together. So I think that's the key, right? It's the people around you. I think you're just a founder with a crazy idea. That's really not worth much if you can't get it. You can't get your grit to the ground. So I don't think so, but what I do have is, I would say, I have that curiosity to figure out things. So spending time to solve a problem. And I do think that none of the companies I've built are that similar, at least from a topical point of view. So it's just an intellectual challenge that I like. And I don't know whether you know Case Collins. He's actually the founder and CEO chairman of Booking.com for the first 12 years until they were the largest client of Google or whatever they were at that point. And he was an investor in one of my companies. He was even COO at Uber next to Travis Kalanick for a while. Anyway, he was an investor. And one of the things he told me was, in a Dutch accent, I won't try it today, but it's not that hard. It's just hard work. So I think that's potentially what I feel is one of the things I learned, not only from him, from that statement, but also maybe from your questions before. I gave a bit of a glimpse. And I think that's where I'm definitely good at potentially bring the best out in people.
Is that also for you? You said this curiosity, but then this working hard ethos, is that also really what now keeps you in entrepreneurship to really get you going?
Yeah, so I do. I love, on the one hand, I just love the intellectual challenge, right? So if you're able to shift, the vertical you're working in, every company is different. And so it's every time it's like a university degree. And so what I do remember, and I didn't cherish it that much when I was studying in St. Gallen or in Rotterdam, but somehow it's something that really is exciting when you learn something new or figure out something new. And in entrepreneurship, that's pretty much your whole job. Whereas, no offense to people who love working at corporates, for me, when I was there, it felt like 95%, maybe 98% of the things I was doing had been done by the person before me. So I just really enjoy the challenges. And maybe I've been lucky that some things have worked. So that helps as well to keep going, right?
Well, that's for sure. And one thing that also turned out pretty well is the company that you founded in 2018, Join.com. Many of us have probably already used it themselves to recruit talent. You're basically a company that is enabling SMEs and also startups around the globe to attract qualified talent faster and more effectively. So far, all of your companies have sort of been in SaaS until that moment, right? Or at least had a SaaS touch until you then started the ominous stealth startup that we're going to talk about in a minute. I just wonder, because there you focus on deep tech and hardware, what are sort of the disadvantages and advantages of building a SaaS company versus a deep tech company? Because you've seen a lot, you like the intellectual challenges. So I just wonder, how do they differentiate from one another?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it depends how you're asking the question, right? Advantages, disadvantages of the model, or for me personally, I'll probably start for me personally. I can start from the model. I mean, SaaS is actually, it's quite easy in the sense that easy to measure, right? You're measuring metrics, whether it's your conversion rate, whether it's your retention rate, whether it's your growth rate, it's all rates, right? And so maybe 2024, the rates are different that lead to a better or worse valuation than it was in 2020. But in general, you know what you should be measuring, you know where you stand. And once you've done it a few times, you potentially even know how to improve some of those metrics to get you to the level that you need to be at. So for me, it felt just from a business model point of view, which is SaaS, not super exciting anymore. And I think I could have stayed there. I even had an offer. It was crazy. Maybe it was 2 years ago, 1.5 years ago. I would have just received $5 million without even the investor knowing what I would do next. And he said, no, he's fine giving it to me because he's pretty sure that we'd get it to work. Not really sure that is the truth, but I felt quite privileged to have that opportunity. But at the same time, deep tech or even hardware, as I'm doing now, it's not only deep tech, it's even physical rather than software. It is extremely challenging. And I think it's something I've never done before. And with, I would say, the privilege of some past experiences, I just feel building a company is something I roughly know how to do. But this is possibly the next challenge. And when we talk about it more afterwards, you'll maybe understand why it's important to me to do this.
Absolutely. And Join, if you look at the success that Join, the company you co-founded, has, it's Europe's fastest growing HR tech company. And yet you only remain as a shareholder. Were you just intellectually a bit too bored to continue in this SaaS environment, not that stimulated? Or why do you choose to stop being operationally active in a company that is sort of just warming up and really, you know, getting all the success that it hardly worked on over the past years?
No, I mean, I wouldn't put that on the intellectual challenge alone. It was really fun. It's a great team and everything, right? And to be fair, there's probably two reasons. So the first one I'll talk about Join, and the second one is why I'm actually not doing something else. So the company's doing well. We're making millions and millions in SaaS revenue. The valuations were obviously lovely for everyone 2 years ago, and it's still good. So I'm not worried. Well, there's about 100 great FTEs that I personally was able to work with over the years as well. They're doing a brilliant job. And my co-founder is great as well. So handing over the reins still makes me sleep well at night. And the company will do well. I think the more importantly now is it was the right moment to actually kick off officially the climate tech company, because the planet isn't waiting for us to save it, right? But we're destroying it every day. So it feels like it's the right moment. And when I look at that, end of 2022 is where we really started working on this. And so in that sense, I think it was a push and a pull factor that allowed me to really start on what I'm doing now. But Join, I think it's a great company and it's based out of Switzerland. So I'm really proud of what we've achieved. And I'm sure that the others will take it home and make it one of the largest and most successful companies coming out of Switzerland.
Absolutely. You certainly set it up for a successful ride in that regard.
Yeah, we hope so.
So let's talk about your new venture. It's in climate tech, as you already mentioned. We've heard that this is urgent, you know, to start solving the climate crisis that has even heavily accentuated from a striking experience that you had in Kandersteg. And I just wonder, tell us a bit more about this story. We hear it's urgent to solve it, but you had this very personal experience that I'm curious to learn more about.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, maybe let me just start from, I mean, I've had the privilege to do great degrees in management and finance and in St. Gallen and Rotterdam, but essentially I'm useless when it comes to building a technical solution, right? It's what a lot of business people understand over time, at least. So if you think about climate, right, we're not going to solve it with software. We definitely need hardware solutions. And now the problem with that is I can't build a hardware solution without a brilliant team. So actually, I was really lucky that this team trusts me over years for different reasons and vice versa. And so it was a great opportunity. And I think one of the key factors, though, that didn't, I would say, ignite my enthusiasm for a moment while still working on it was in software, or just let's say in the world, there's a lot of things about instant gratification. But deep tech is years of work before you see anything. And climate is a problem that we're trying to solve in 2050, right? So essentially, or by 2050, we need to solve certain things. So it's not something that during our youthful years, we'll even get to see Sylvan, right? So for me, that was sort of one of the things that didn't trigger me. But in Kandersteg, your question, I was there in February. And actually, it's famous for cross-country skiing. So you see all these signs, but zero snow. And it was one of those moments that I felt emotional being Swiss these days, as well as I'm English. And there was literally nobody in the peak of the season that could cross cross-country ski. And you really felt, when you read the news and when you look at things like that, you really feel it. It's not instant gratification, it's the opposite. It's instant horror. And in that sense, for me, it was sort of one of those moments where I then really felt proud of what the team's doing and really feel extremely strongly about what we're trying to achieve as a team, essentially decarbonizing the world with one of our products.
Amazing. And if you take a bit of deeper look at your CV, you know, this all makes a ton of sense, what you just described. And this must have been quite a wake-up call in terms of an experience to really say, hey, we need to do something. At the same time, we look at your CV and we see you've worked for Shell in the past. And I just wonder, with this new climate-conscious mindset that you have here, tackling these big problems that we face as humanity, how do you look back on working for Shell, who basically is sort of a key contributor to where we are today in at least one way or the other?
I agree with you. I would even remove the sort of from your statement, right? It's one of the key contributors, full stop. So yeah, I was hoping you wouldn't ask anything about that, but it's on my LinkedIn, right? But basically, I think what I can say is I'm not super proud of it based on where we are today as a human race and based on what I'm doing. At the same time, there's probably two things. Back then, I was maybe looking at the shiny things, right? I actually started my career in 2008, believe it or not. And that was pretty much in the midst of this financial crisis. The day I got the contract from Shell was the day after I handed in my private equity thesis at the University of St. Gallen. And it was pretty much on par, pretty much give or take a couple of days, when Lehman Brothers folded. So for me, the financial world wasn't the right way to go. But Shell at that point had the highest barrel prices. So it was a financial decision more than anything else. But I really, as you can see, you would know that because you've done good research, I didn't stay even a full year there because I really realized I couldn't get behind it. But paradoxically, you have to say, these companies have deep pockets, so they may be the ones that also help us finance our way out of it. But I think you need to stay as independent from them as possible until it's inevitable what we're doing. And then maybe getting a bit of cash from them, not for us per se, but for people in this industry, will help finance getting to where we need to go.
Yeah, I mean, these companies are in quite a dilemma, right? On one hand, they want to still stay relevant in the future, so they have to heavily invest and probably also invest in new technologies and new hardware. On the other hand, if they do so, they also jeopardize the core business that is the money-making machine today. So that is a pretty tough spot to be in. But let's talk about your company, your stealth climate tech venture. Climate tech is pretty broad. So what is the specific problem that you guys are solving with your company?
Yeah, really good question. I mean, it's stealth on LinkedIn, but we're slowly seeping out. So I'll give you a little bit of an insight today. But basically, if you think about it, you talked about Shell. That's predominantly oil. You think about gas and you think about coal. Those are the fossil fuels, right? Essentially, what we're focusing on are gas turbines. So let's say one third of fossil fuel, which is probably more than 80% of CO2 emissions, is caused by gas turbines. And the problem about gas turbines is they run on a fossil fuel called gas. So what have we done is these gas turbines have a so-called burner. And that burner is where the fuel ignites, etc. And basically, it's what drives them the turbine to achieve what it needs to achieve and drive power, for example. And now what we've done, especially the technical team again, we've developed the first of a kind in the world burner technology that enables a gas turbine to run 100% on renewable fuel, for example, hydrogen, but also other zero and low carbon fuels. And by that, let's just give an example, a 100 megawatt gas turbine will emit up to about 600,000 tons of CO2 every year. And with our technology, with the right fuel, that goes to zero. So if you think about it, we're decarbonizing a massive segment in the world, and we hope that we can get our product into the market faster. So let's see where that goes.
This episode was brought to you by Google Cloud, a partner that needs no introduction. What you might not have heard of, though, is that Google offers a Google for Startups cloud program where they give you access to startup experts, technical training, business support, and cover your Google Cloud costs up to $200,000 for 2 years, or even $350,000 if you're an AI startup. Scale your startup faster and smarter with Google Cloud. Head over to goo.cloud bit.ly/Swisspreneur. Amazing. That sounds like a very, very promising technology that you're developing and bringing to the market right there. You mentioned hydrogen is one potential source for, you know, the turbines that you are powering, basically. What are sort of the pros and cons of using hydrogen? And will that be the main use case in your scenario?
Yeah, good question. I think that's a debate that humanity needs to go forwards 10 years, and then we can look back and say, okay, I told you so. But fundamentally, right, it's a lot of topics. So you have taxes on CO2. You have incentives to go green. You have fuel costs where hydrogen for sure is high, but it won't be more expensive when it gets more abundant. You have gas issues with where they come from, right? When you think about the war to the east of Europe, you're pretty worried about being dependent on certain countries when it comes to gas. So there's a lot of, I would say, macroeconomical and even sociopolitical topics that you need to think through when you discuss this topic. But fundamentally, there are trillions of dollars of infrastructure in the gas turbine area. And a lot of people don't know that most district heating comes out of gas turbines. So you don't need to just replace the gas turbine. You need to replace heating if you turn them off. So we believe that with our technology, it's not only a future-proof technology for new builds, it also can retrofit the tens of thousands of gas turbines in the world. And by doing that, you're pretty much saving money because you're just spending a couple of million to retrofit your gas turbine rather than hundreds of millions to build a new infrastructure around it. So we believe when you do the full cost calculation, especially in a couple of years, it'll be a global phenomenon. Today already, some gas turbine operators tell us that our technology will be more economical for them today. And just to be sure that it's clear, not everybody knew this, maybe I didn't even know this a few years ago, if you run on hydrogen, you have zero CO2. So it is also important that you use the right fuel. And we have built a so-called multi-fuel technology, so it can run on also other fuels in case hydrogen isn't necessarily in all over the world the right fuel to go with in the next 5, 10, 20 years. I hope that answered the question. It wasn't too technical. Let's see.
It did. And I love one thing that you said. It's your capability of retrofitting or equipping current turbines out there instead of completely replacing them, because that will take probably not even years, but decades to complete. And you will probably face a lot of resistance from the companies running them because they are sitting on their balance sheets and they don't want to replace them because there's just some new technology out there. They just made a huge financial investment. But your technology actually is plugging into the existing turbines out there and solving a real problem. That is, for me, a game changer, the way that you can do that with your technology. So I got to ask, you know, it sounds so simple and I'm not technical at all, but why hasn't that been done before?
Yeah. So, well, that would take us a couple of hours to go through what the market dynamics are. But you can imagine that the Siemens and the GEs of this world are potentially not only the ones who build the turbines, but also burners. They just haven't focused on that. But it comes down to what you just said, right? It's creative destruction that a lot of people can't get to grip with, that their technology or their business model might be actually something of the past. So they're not necessarily shifting to what they need to for the future until the regulators tell them to. And they're not yet, right? So that's the one thing. More importantly, I like to make this example. If you drive, let's say, a zero carbon example here, but if you drive a BMW or if you drive an Audi, you may go to the Audi garage with your Audi or the BMW garage with your BMW, but both of them could go to an independent garage. And in the gas turbine space, if you think about it, it's actually the dominant way people service their turbine, in this case, rather than a car. And because of that, 60% of the market is operated by people who aren't the innovators, like Siemens and Co. And so these people, even though they know they're driving at 100 miles an hour towards a wall, they don't know how to innovate themselves out of exactly what you said, their CapEx, the capital expenditure dilemma, because they've spent millions, they don't know how to get out of it, so they just keep doing what they're doing. And so that's why we believe the whole market dynamic, in combination with our go-to-market strategy, maybe our business skills also came well into play there, allow us to have a really good entrance to the market. So we'll be installing this year because a lot of large players believe that we're the only ones and have confirmed it that can do this in the world.
Amazing. And when we talk about the timing, you know, this is a really important part to make or break a company. You can usually not really influence the timing, but better understand where you stand in terms of the timing. So what role do regulations and also politics play in that regard? Because we sort of see a more tightening up in that regard, that you want to have taxes on CO2 emissions in the futures, but still they're often still not just there yet to really force these players to change. So what role do regulations and politics play for your vision and for your plans?
Yeah. No, I think in general, right, timing is something that's important, and timing of regulations will be key for us making a good company to making a game changer globally, right? And luckily for us, actually, one of the regulations is called on NOx, nitrous oxides, also a greenhouse gas like CO2. They're coming in 2025, and they're going to make in Europe, as well as US, tens of thousands of gas turbines non-compliant. So they need a new technology. First of all, we can also reduce NOx, just so that you understand that part. So our technology is relevant regardless of what happens on CO2 taxes and hydrogen. The next phase is, you're right? Will people change if they're not forced to by regulators? And I believe, to be romantic sometimes, and I believe they should. But at the same time, studying economics, I wouldn't necessarily do that, at least not as the first mover. But regulators will enforce it when they see the first turbines running with our technology, because then they know we actually have an alternative. And until now, there wasn't one. So I think that's an extremely important key to unlocking the market. And that's why we're gunning together with a couple of our multi-billion dollar clients, actually, quite crazy. We're gunning to actually go into the first turbines this year. And we have contracts to do it into hundreds of turbines, which is exciting, over the next 10 years. But important for me is actually getting into an engine in the next 12 months.
Amazing. Yeah. That sounds like a very good plan. And you mentioned large companies. So how does your sort of go-to-market strategy look like? Because you can, of course, try to sell your solution on your own, but you could also partner up with people who already have a network and probably the right relationships in the right place to speed things up a bit. What is your game plan there?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, right, you want to do everything on your own. But I realized also quite early on in my entrepreneurship days, you actually need great people around you and great partners. So we believe the best go-to-market strategy is quite simply with some of the largest players in the industry, because at the end of the day, you also need to think about it, right? It's a high barrier to entrance market with huge multi-billion companies in some kind of oligarchy, I would say, because it's not hundreds of players in the market. So we've signed contracts with two of the largest, because we believe, A, it will enable the end clients to trust us in the combination of that partnership. And we also believe that access to market helps us. And our technology, on the other hand, helps our partners, because they can be the first movers in a market that they'd like to take market share. So it's a win-win-win all around on that level. There will be losers and winners, of course, but we can talk about that another day.
Amazing. Love that. And, you know, when we think about getting partners on board, getting the idea out there, you are in stealth mode, at least on LinkedIn for now. Shouldn't you be getting out there and asking as many people as possible for feedback on your idea and even your technology as possible?
Yeah, so you're not wrong, right? I always say, is there a reason to be stealth? And usually there isn't. At the same time, it's not a B2C game, right? So I don't need feedback from the 8 million people in Switzerland or the 8 billion people globally yet, right? The feedback from them will come when ideally we're cleaning up the CO2 in the world, at least being part of the solution. But at the same time, it was important to cross a few milestones to feel extremely confident before we unveil too much towards other players. But I think the time is probably in the next few weeks that we'll be unveiling it more. But I can tell you that we have signed a very large Swiss company called Sulzer, which is one of the largest players in the world. And the company is called Crosstown, and we're scaling it right now. So that's sort of where we stand. And it's exciting times, because there are exciting press news that will be coming over the next few weeks as well about what we've been doing.
I think you just did a premiere on the show. You just unveiled the name of your startup that was in stealth before we started recording, and now it's sort of public. I love that.
That's cool. I didn't know that. I haven't managed to see all the episodes, to be fair, but if you say so, I trust you.
The first one. And one last question in terms of the stealth mode. You know, sometimes you also just don't want to give your competitors a glimpse on what you're up to, but you might also have any patents or processing any patents that might make it even a requirement to not be that public about it yet. So how does your IP landscape look like? Do you own any patents or are you in the process of obtaining some?
Yes, we do. And everything we're working on and everything we built has been built by the team that is basically working with Crosstown. So we're really proud about that. And at the end of the day, I think it is a key. It's not the only key to be able to build a successful business, but I've learned, especially in hardware, it's one of the topics. So me as a first-time hardware founder or deep tech hardware founder, it's something that I think is very important. And we're happy that we progress fairly well through the patenting process.
And the patent is also something that investors, of course, like to see because it gives you some sort of a moat to defend your company against any other competitors. Are you currently raising any funds? Because hardware and, you know, climate tech, that all sort of screams like, oh, you need a lot of funds to put that into reality. So are you raising any funds at the moment?
So I need to put that into context. Important is a lot of hardware companies need significant funds. We're extremely CapEx low, and we actually have negative working capital, which for those of you who aren't financially that literate who are listening, maybe that's a positive thing because you can finance your growth through extra, or well, basically organically through funds that you generate from your revenues. But that said, we would like to move faster over the next few months. And we would like to make sure that our burner technology gets into more turbines than we already contracted today. So in that context, long story short, we are raising funds. We're doing a 4 million seed round, as they call it, of which we've already been able to secure more than half of it. And so right now, Sylvan, I'm talking to some exciting lead investors on a couple of the continents out there. So it's exciting.
I imagine. I see your excitement in your eyes. And you have raised rounds before. You have raised funds before. How does that experience now with a hardware company sort of compare to your previous fundraising efforts that you already went through?
Yeah, so I mean, it's completely different. I mean, I'm smiling, you said, but actually I'm in pain every day because when it comes to fundraising and hardware, it's really different. So if you think about a Venn diagram, two circles that cross, and in the middle you have an overlap, and that's where you need to go. On the left-hand side are investors I know, and I've met quite a few over the last 10 years, and friends with some of them even. And on the right-hand side are investors that invest in deep tech, in climate, in hardware, and in 2024, even still investing. So on all those four levels, I've realized that the two circles of my Venn diagram don't overlap. So it's extremely difficult. But that said, it's very different. And I think what's interesting and sad, maybe even at the same time, is I didn't realize that venture capital is very limited on the hardware side, and especially hardware that is cutting edge and very difficult to understand, which I understand in a way. You can't validate it so easily. So long story short, I think it's great that we've already been able to raise more than half of the round. But at the same time, getting that lead investor will be, yeah, I think more work than it's been in the past to get around done. But again, like I said at the beginning, it's nothing I shy away from. I actually enjoy the challenge. So looking forward to finishing the round in the next couple of months.
It's yet another intellectual challenge for Manoush to get to solve, basically.
I'm not sure it's that intellectual, but sure. challenge.
It's more of a, you need to get it done, not that intellectually challenging. Let's talk about the future. So you are fundraising, you're further developing and strengthening the product, getting up the go-to-market strategy. Do you already have a tentative launch date for your company when the first products will actually be out there in the market and being used?
Yeah, no. So I'll answer that in a couple of ways. The company is already founded, so that's important. Your question was more around the product. And we can't, it's not like putting it on a shelf, right? So we do need to work with our go-to-market partners and then decide when is the next turbine servicing window, when a burner will be installed. So they actually have even their rough timelines. But excitingly for us, that timeline should be Q4 this year, latest Q1 2025, which in the hardware world is very fast. So we're really excited because that will then actually not only show in the testing rig, the product's ready. It's been tested at actual real world conditions, but now it needs to be put in a real live turbine that is actually operating for humanity. So we're quite relaxed because that's just a question of when rather than a question of if. So that's when we'll be launching.
Fantastic. We stay tuned from the sidelines and follow your exciting journey. Now, you sort of, it seems like you found your new calling, you know, with the new company, with Crosstown. At the same time, I know that you've also done so much in the past, as you have already heard. So I just wonder, besides business, what is next for you, Manoush, personally?
Oh, that's a really hard question. So actually, I set myself a couple of goals. I think I've neglected my close friends and family a bit too much over the last 10, 15 years. So a personal goal for this year is actually to be much more available, or at least make sure that I meet people. So if you're bored on the 22nd, Sylvain, give me a quick WhatsApp. I have something planned. I won't say more because I'm on a podcast, apparently. So at the same time, I want to become a tennis professional. I've had 3 lessons this year already in total in my life. So it's going to be hard, but I would like to be able to play the game at a certain level. So very excited to join the senior tour sometime in the next couple of years. Those are 2 things.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Because Roger Federer retired, so now there's room for another champ in Switzerland.
Yeah, I think that won't happen. But definitely, if you want to hit a few balls, I'm open for it a couple of days a week at the moment.
Perfect. And Manoush, to wrap up the conversation today, we also would like to give you some rapid-fire questions, quick questions or different options to choose from, and you have to answer in one sentence. You ready?
Yeah.
What city do you call home?
Zurich.
Now, because it was Berlin and London before, right?
So London, I was born there. Zurich, I think, is home. Berlin is a home away from home. So I spend time between both. But right now I'm in Zurich, just so you know.
It's a pretty cool triangle.
Yes, for sure.
Where's your favorite surfing spot?
Well, to be fair, there's only really one answer. And that's because I'm not a very good surfer. And I started surfing last year. And the water's warm. The sea's not too rough. And I'm a terrible swimmer. It's very shallow there as well. And the answer is Veligama. But it's a really cool place in Sri Lanka on the south coast. And there are so many Swiss, German, Europeans in general hanging out there. So it even feels European when you go there. So that's the answer. Veligama, for those who don't know it.
Fantastic. And we stick to the traveling part. You are quite a traveler yourself. What's your favorite country to be a tourist in?
So it's interesting. I'd actually call myself a tourist rather than a traveler. My definition is a tourist is someone who goes to places briefly, and a traveler is someone who really takes time. So I've realized that actually I'm really an avid traveler of Europe again, because I did a road trip from Switzerland down through Italy and then across to Montenegro and then up back to Switzerland. And I really have to say, although Italy's so close, it comes in first just before Switzerland because it's a bit larger, maybe, really exploring. And I've been really discovering places that you don't discover if you take a plane somewhere. When you drive through and walk through cities, it's way more interesting. So I'd say Italy right now for strange reasons.
Love that. And how many hours of sleep did he get last night?
Oh, that's, am I looking that bad on the call? I actually got
no,
enough.
No, you're not, but I know a bit the background. That's why I ask it.
Yeah, no, so I got a solid 4.5 hours sleep, but I'm going to catch up on the weekend for sure.
Well, usually you don't need that much sleep, you once told me, right?
I would say you probably could do with more, but I'm capable of functioning with a limited amount. So that helps me put in the extra shift maybe sometimes when I'm building a company.
I bet you're right. And what's the most valuable lesson that entrepreneurship has taught you so far?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, how shall I do that sharp? Well, it's the most fun job in the world. And I think I really enjoy it. And if that's a job. But I think when you put great minds together and they're really having fun, I think that entrepreneurs can really solve a lot of the problems for humanity. So I think that's one of the things that I've learned. It doesn't matter how old or how young or how experienced or non-experienced you are. I think if you've got a reasonable head screwed on tight and you want to work with great people and you don't shy away from the big problems, it's really fun and exciting. So I think that's something that it's taught me.
No, Roger, that 100%. And the last one I want to ask you, because you had to say goodbye to projects you started multiple times, whether they were acquired or you decided to move on to something else and left your operation role. How do you decide when it's time to move on and let go and start something new?
That's a really good question. I think for me, there's probably a couple of answers, but the most romantic one is, I think, you realize when you've had the impact you can have as a person or as a company. And I believe there's always a moment to move on. At the same time, you realize there might be something else that you can have a massive impact on. And I think then it's time to also join that company. So it's a combination. Sometimes if you sell a company, that decision is easier, financially speaking. But at the same time, it's always difficult to leave your baby behind. But I really think if you can leave it behind in good hands, you're actually, getting more companies that can do something good in the world to the world. So that's how I feel about that.
That's the perfect way to end this episode. Manoush, thank you so much for coming on the show. I wish you all the best with Crosstown and the big challenges, the important challenges that you're tackling and hopefully solving for us here on planet Earth. And I'm sure we're going to hear and see much more from you in the future. Thank you so much and all the best.
Hopefully. Thanks a lot. Likewise. See you soon, Sivan.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.